Welcome to Rear Vision on RN, RA and via the web. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today the story of sport, gender and the Cold War.
The sport's governing body has ordered Semenya to undergo physical and psychological tests to prove she's not a man.
I'm not going to allow that girl to be humiliated in the manner that she was humiliated, because she has not committed any crime whatsoever. Her crime was to be born the way she's born.
Later this month, Caster Semenya, the South African sprinter whose gender was questioned 3 years ago, will compete at the London Olympics. Semenya had won the 800 metres at the 2009 World Athletics Championship in Berlin. But her victory was thrown into doubt when questions were raised about her gender. Semenya was required to undergo a series of tests to verify her gender and was banned from competing. A year later, the International Amateur Athletics Federation accepted the conclusion of a panel of medical experts which stated that Semenya could compete in women's events. While Caster Semenya survived the ban and the surrounding media controversy, it must have had a profound effect as she was only 18 years old at the time. Semenya, however, is not the only elite athlete to have had her gender questioned. You may be surprised to learn that for over 50 years, all elite women athletes had to prove they were actually women, and a number didn't pass the test. The story begins in the 1950s. The Cold War was underway, and Eastern Bloc women athletes were outperforming their Western rivals. These were big, strong women whose performances and appearances shocked the West. Dr. Elizabeth Ferris is a former research fellow at King's College in London and competed in the 1960s Olympics.
In the late 50s and early 60s, there were a number of women track and field athletes, in particular from the Eastern Bloc countries, who were showing physical signs that were more or less feminine than people had come to expect. And it was a time when, culturally, women were expected to be very feminine, if you remember. And a fear, therefore, built up, a sort of rumour, innuendo, all sorts of things, that maybe these women weren't completely a female. Now, I don't know what anyone thought that meant, really, but the signs were that they were showing much bigger muscle bulk. They had deepening of the voice, certain amount of hair on the face, and they were very big and strong, and very importantly, they were producing incredible performances. And therefore, these women were performing in a way that people thought, quote, normal women couldn't perform. And therefore, there was something strange about them. One fear was, are they really men masquerading as women? When that idea got hold, then it was decided, well, we can't have cheating, men masquerading as women, so we must have a test for women, because it would be unfair to women if men were masquerading in their competitions.
Sports officials responded to these suspicions by introducing a sex test for all women athletes. And at first, this was just a simple visual inspection.
In those days, there was no very technical things, pulling out hair or taking smears or anything like that. It was, please remove your clothes and let's have a look. And it was quite embarrassing for everybody.
Rosemary Grimes was a British and Commonwealth record holder in the discus and was one of the first women tested in 1966.
We knew that they were afraid that there might be somebody who was masculine masquerading in the women's event. We had never felt any danger that there might be, but there were certainly jokes and rumours around, particularly about the press sisters and one or two other East European competitors. There was some anxiety expressed about whether they were definitely women or not. And it was certainly rather mysterious that several East European competitors suddenly stopped competing. They were not really too old, and that they were at the height of their athletics prowess, but suddenly they just didn't appear anymore when it was becoming official to have sex testing before big events.
The International Amateur Athletic Federation introduced an inspection, a physical inspection test, and 243 female athletes all paraded in front of three doctors in the nude, apart from holding their passports. And all of these athletes were pronounced normal, quote, normal. Understandably, they all also found it very demeaning. But the important thing was that five world record holders who were expected to compete in Budapest didn't appear. Now, these were the very women who had caused people to have some concern about their, quote, femininity, unquote. And they included the two press sisters, Tamara, who was the double Olympic champion in shot put and discus, and her sister Irina, also double Olympic champion in the 80 metres hurdle and the pentathlon. The reason given for them not turning up was that their mother was ill. Now, no one knew why, and it's never been proven one way or the other why these women didn't come. But let it be said that these women are still living as women in their own countries. They certainly were not men masquerading and cheating. Whether they had some other, perhaps genetic difference from a normal woman, we don't know. But they were not men, they were women.
And what we now know is that in the late 50s and early 60s, sport had become part of the Cold War. And Eastern Bloc women athletes were being trained seriously alongside their male counterparts. They may also have had access to steroids, which would have explained their appearance.
They were getting better training. I mean, during the 50s, the training in lots of sports really shot forward the technology and the physiology and the knowledge about sports science really took a jump. And also, women were much more willing to train very hard, particularly in Eastern Bloc countries. The other thing was that anabolic steroids really started to be used in America in the 50s in the bodybuilding gymnasiums. But nobody knew about it. And for all we know, these athletes, men and women presumably, but the women may have been the first generation to take anabolics. Certainly the signs that they were showing could have just as easily be caused by anabolic steroids, the deepening of the voice and the facial hair and the increased muscle bulk and the increased performance.
When we were in Kiev, we were actually taken off as a group to the local maternity hospital. And there, those of us who had been tested before, of course we felt pretty confident. Those of us even who had children and things before felt reasonably confident. But I remember there were some young folks on our team who were extremely upset because we were actually taken into what looked like a delivery room and actually had to lie back, put our feet up in the stirrups as if we were going to deliver a baby. And for those of us who had children, we sort of joked about it, you know. But for some of the young ones, it was a very, very harrowing experience. However, in Kiev, that was the first time I'd actually come across a competitor being excluded from the competition because of it. So that brought it home to us that it was rather serious. It wasn't just a joke. Ostatnie 100 metrów. Ewa Klobukowska
rwie do mety jak uskrzydlona. Już nikt jej nie zagrozi. Good evening. This is Ewa Klobukowska of Poland. Blonde, 21 years old, Olympic gold medalist, and co-holder of the Women's World 100 metres record. A superb woman athlete. Or at least that's what everyone thought until this weekend, when it was ruled that Ewa is not a woman. In a sex test at the European Games at Kiev, it was found that Ewa has one chromosome too many to qualify as a female, and so she was ruled ineligible for the meeting.
In Kiev, the tragedy was that the Polish sprinter, Ewa Klobukowska, who had passed the inspection in 1966 in Budapest, didn't pass the close-up visual inspection in Kiev. And the awful thing for her was that it was very, very public. She was publicly disqualified and were not allowed to compete. A six-doctor commission looked at her case and did chromosome karyotyping. And what they discovered was that some of her cells had the normal XX chromosomes, but some of them had XXY. So she had some of them had the extra Y bit. And what this meant was that she probably had a certain ambiguity, perhaps, of her external genitalia. But again, she was absolutely a woman. She still lives as a woman in her own country. And the awful thing for her was that in 1970, the IAAF stripped her of all her records.
We were absolutely amazed because we knew her quite well. I mean, we had language difficulty, but we had seen her in competitions before. We'd been used to competing against her, and no questions had ever been asked by us, certainly. But apparently, she didn't meet the test. And we were all heart sorry for her because, you know, she wasn't sort of whisked away and told not to come back or anything. She actually stayed there and her teammates rallied round and she came to the official functions and so on. I think more heavily made up and more femininely dressed than I'd ever seen her. She was probably trying to compensate, poor girl. And we just thought it was terrible. We were all so sorry for her. You know, we would gladly have welcomed her into the competition if we could, because we were sure that, you know, this just couldn't be right, what was happening. And more ways were being introduced to do the testing. The favourite method for a while was to pull out a hair from the scalp and examine the hair roots. And that was done several times. I remember almost having a bald patch once because they kept pulling out so many hairs and they kept breaking. And then I heard that that was also being questioned as to its accuracy. And then the next method that was used was to take a smear from inside the mouth. And I don't know all the medical details about it, but even that was criticised later as not necessarily being accurate. So we were always suspicious of them. We always felt that the tests were being done, but one could never be sure whether they were accurate or not.
At the Mexico Olympics in 1968, the International Olympic Committee introduced a new genetic sex test.
Into the great silver bowl and the flame ignites!
After Kiev, the next year was the Olympic Games in Mexico, and the International Olympic Committee, the IOC, realised that something had to change. They could not go on with this humiliating procedure. So what they did was they introduced a different kind of test. It was easy, it was quick, it was cheap, and it protected the sensitivities of the women athletes. This test was called the buccal smear test for bar bodies. And what it is they scraped a few cells off the inside of the mouth. They were spread onto a slide. The slide was stained and looked at under a microscope. And what was being looked for was in the cells a highly stained dot on the edge of the nucleus. And what this dot was one of the X chromosomes. In women, the normal sex chromosome configuration is two X's. In men, the normal configuration is X and a Y. The assumption in this test is that if you have XX sex chromosomes, then you're a woman. And if you don't have XX sex chromosomes, then in some way or other, you're not a woman sufficiently to be allowed to compete in female competition in sport. And that's the problem, because it's an assumption that sex and gender, it can be traced to one aspect, which is chromosomes and genes. And the fact is that whilst that's the start of the journey of sexual differentiation, it is not by any means the end. There are women who actually have XY chromosomes. And these women fail the test and they have been unfairly disqualified.
You're with Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today the story behind the sex testing of female athletes. While the vast majority of women have XX chromosomes and men XY, there are females, around 1 in 40,000, born with XY chromosomes. It's a condition known as androgen insensitivity, and it was these women who were picked up by the new genetic sex test. Professor Hughes from the Department of Paediatrics at Cambridge University argues that despite having XY chromosomes, these athletes were and are female and actually have no physical advantage over other women athletes.
In this particular condition, they genetically, like males, they have an X chromosome and a Y chromosome, but they turn out to be female simply because during fetal life, the body just doesn't respond to the action of that male hormone produced by the testes.
And so, really, do we regard them as males or females?
They are regarded, and we should regard them entirely as normal females.
And do they have any advantage over other females in terms of strength or height or anything like that?
Well, that's the crazy part of making them fail because of the sex test, because by definition, they are resistant to the action of the male hormone. And therefore, they do not have any greater bulk muscles than a normal female. And therefore, I think they are really shouldn't be discriminated against just because of failing the so-called positive test.
In an ideal world, they would have gone on and had other tests, chromosome, karyotyping, gynecological tests, hormonal tests. But the problem about this test is that it was always done, as it were, on the eve of their competition. They were actually at the Olympic Games, or later on at a World Championships. And you can imagine, I mean, if you were about to enter the race of your life or whatever, and you'd had this test and somebody said, I'm sorry, there's a problem. You're going to have to withdraw, fake an injury, tie up your ankle, because there's something wrong with your test. It was so traumatic for a number of women that they just had to withdraw and hide, basically. I mean, the humiliation would have been so great. Many of them just didn't want to know anymore, so they didn't go ahead and have the other tests. Had they gone ahead and had them, they would have been allowed to carry on, but they didn't. And the reason was that they didn't have the right advice, they didn't have the right counselling, they didn't understand the situation, nor did a lot of the people advising them. Even some of the team doctors didn't really understand the ins and outs of the test and what it meant. Consequently, to protect the women, they were advised to just withdraw, and they just disappeared.
One female athlete who failed the test and didn't just disappear was Maria Patino. Maria was the Spanish national record holder in hurdles. She was originally tested in 1983 and passed. But 2 years later, at the World Student Games in Japan, she was retested. She'd forgotten to bring her femininity card. That test recorded an abnormality. Maria had both X and Y chromosomes.
I think the time in Japan was the most difficult time of my life. Because I felt very alone.
Nobody persons speak me about what happened. I feel very, very bad, very bad. Yo me he sentido muy mal, porque yo me encontraba solamente a unos pocos metros de poder tomar la salida para volver a competir en vallas y yo no podía correr.
I felt terrible because I was so close to competing, but I couldn't run. My rivals were there and I couldn't compete with them. I didn't sleep at all the night before the competition. I felt terrible. I was so alone.
Yo intenté hablar con los mejores médicos, pero realmente no he tenido el apoyo suficiente. Yo pienso que
I tried to speak to the best doctors, but there was really no one there to support me. I think things should have been much clearer. The tests weren't conclusive. You can't make such a crucial decision about an athlete without doing more tests. But in my case, that's just what happened.
And so in Japan, how did you get out of competing? Did you fake an injury or what happened?
Yes. Yo hablé de que tenía un problema in my feet. I feel bad.
I said I had something wrong with my feet. I felt very bad. I felt just terrible. I trained so hard to compete.
I don't understand nothing.
For Maria, there was a happy ending. With the help of a number of medical specialists and the support of the then chairman of the IAAF medical committee, her ban was reversed.
And how did you feel when you were finally allowed to compete again?
Maybe it's the best moment in my life.
A journalist called me in Seoul saying, Maria, I believe that the medical committee of the IAAF has finally decided you can go back to competing. Well, I burst into tears. It was 3 a.m. and I couldn't go back to sleep. I was so happy. I couldn't believe that all this was happening to me. I felt fantastic.
Y yo me he sentido muy bien. El mejor momento de mi vida, the best moment in my life, sure.
Why did you choose to fight? Like, why did you stand up to the Federation?
Why? Yo me he sentido siempre una mujer.
If I decide not to compete anymore, it's my decision.
I felt always woman. Now I can compete with another woman.
In 1981, I wrote to Dr. Hay, who is a gynecologist in Mexico who is on the IOC Medical Commission, and he actually evolved and instigated this test in the Olympics. And I wrote in 81, and it had been being used since 1968. And he said in his reply to me that in every Olympic Games, since they'd started using the test, there had been failures of the test, and at least a dozen over that 12 years. Well, we're now another 12 years further on. So, you know, you can imagine that there would be at least a couple of dozen. That's only in the Olympics. Professor Ferguson Smith and I worked it out from the figures we did have. And because of the confidentiality and secrecy, it's very difficult to know how many women have actually failed this test. But we worked it out that it's at least 1 in 400 to 500 of women athletes tested. And that's probably, it's probably more than that.
By the early 1990s, athletes and sports officials were both beginning to question the need for a sex test. Arnie Lundquist was the chairman of the IAAF Medical Committee when he spoke to me in 1991.
We have to realise what is sex testing intended to achieve. And there is a general opinion on this, and I'm happy to say that. And that is to eliminate the possibility of men to go into women's competition. Now, what would you do in order to achieve that? You would, of course, inspect the individuals and make sure that they are not men. And the scientifically proper way to do that is just to look at them and investigate whether they are men or women or go into women's competition. You don't do that primary screening by looking into hormones or looking into cell biology or looking into genes or looking into chromosomes, because there are so much individual variations that you can't do it that way. Now, the second argument is that what may have well been a problem some 25 years ago when this was once instituted does not necessarily be a problem today. Top competitive sport today is so much observed by the general society, by the mass media, by everybody, that any man who appears in female competition would very soon be revealed. I mean, it's fancy not to believe that. And thirdly, should, against all odds, any man try to intrude into women's competition, he will be identified in the doping station, because in top international competitions today, it is such an extensive doping control program prevailing. And we know from recent cases, at least, that the urine has to be given under very close observation. And I would say that no man would dare to risk to go into a female competition knowing that he will be asked to present himself at the women's doping station. I mean, it's virtually impossible. So therefore, we decided, since there is no need, really, for an additional sex test, and since there is no other appropriate sex test available than just visual inspection, and knowing that this is sort of intimate matter for the individual, we have decided simply to skip the sex testing. And this is actually the request we have from the scientific world, that look here, is a sex test really needed for sport? And the answer is probably today no.
In 1992, the IAAF ceased sex testing. And in 1999, the IOC followed suit. But the IAAF did retain the right to test individual athletes if there was some suspicion about their gender. And that's exactly what happened to Caster Semenya.
A hero's welcome for South Africa's returning athletes. Among them, the women's 800 metres world champion, Caster Semenya.
She's our golden girl, Caster Semenya.
18-year-old Caster Semenya arrived at the World Championships in Berlin 2 weeks ago, a virtual unknown. But all that changed dramatically when she won gold.
I don't know what to say. Yeah, it's pretty good to win a gold medal and bring it home.
Hours before her stunning performance, it was revealed that athletics' world governing body had demanded she undergo a genetic test to determine her gender.
After Berlin, Caster Semenya was required to undergo a series of tests before she was allowed to compete again. While her gender isn't going to be questioned at the London Olympics, it could happen to another female athlete. The IOC, like the IAAF, retains the right to question an athlete's gender. Claudia Wiesemann is a medical ethicist.
Both retain that right, and if there is a serious suspicion that something is, quote, wrong, unquote, with the athlete, then in order to compete, the athlete will have to undergo thorough testing procedures and a medical examination. In London, for example, although under a different heading, what is going on behind the scene is just the same as before.
The testing process is very arduous, because I'm thinking about what happened to Caster Semenya. It took almost a year before something came back that said she could continue to compete.
It really takes some time to get all the results necessary to have a complete picture, or nearly complete picture, and particularly the genetic testing can become very complicated. In the end, you have a kind of mosaic picture, and then you have to interpret out of these 10 or 20 different single results, you have to make a kind of binary a diagnosis, like male or female. The underlying problem is that this is often impossible.
You argue that requiring really any female athlete to be tested is morally and ethically wrong. Can you explain why?
First of all, let us remind us that genetic testing in itself has a discriminatory potential. For example, we know this from sickle cell anemia in the United States that was used to ban African American from the workplace. Genetic testing is potentially dangerous. And that is also true for genetic testing in case of so-called sex determination, because many people, and particularly sportswomen, are not aware of the fact that there could be something complicated. Gender testing has a high potential of humiliating and discriminating somebody. If you do this in sports, you at least have to take into account the harm that is affected by such a testing. On the other hand, the benefits are not really clear. For example, like in the case of Caster Semenya, where after 1 year of testing, nothing really changed. But she had experienced humiliation worldwide, in fact. She was a globally exposed person after that.
So with the Olympics coming up, how do we then balance that whole notion of someone potentially cheating in an event like the Olympics?
If you look into history, study all these cases that are often mentioned, you can see that these persons did not want to cheat and who did not even know about their personal condition. These are all human tragedies, in fact.
Claudia Wiesemann, ending today's program. Our other guests were Dr. Elizabeth Ferris, Arnie Lindquist, athlete Maria Patino, Professor Hughes, and Rosemary Grimes. Today's sound engineer is Jennifer Parsonage, and this is Rear Vision on RN. I'm Annabelle Quince. Thanks as always for your company.
On By Design, we explore our nation's capital, Canberra. When the idea for a new capital was tendered out to competition, the planners wanted a city that would rival London in size, Athens in art, and Paris in beauty. And with 137 entries, what might it have looked like had somebody else, not Walter Burley Griffin, won the competition? So join me, Fenella Kernebone, for By Design, whenever you like it, at abc.net.au/radionational.